These continue to be the recollections of Turner Ashby, memories of the years when the oceans rose and the several states were separated asunder. 3. That was probably the most idiotic thing you've ever done, Turner. That was Lays, my darling, Lays Fitzgerald, saying that to me. I'd left her a poem, a love poem, the first in a series, I'd hoped. It was a sonnet written in perfectly, fairly adequate, iambic pentameter. I'd left it in her middle school locker. We were 13. I'd left the poem in a seventh grade locker, and she did not find it until we had entered the eighth grade. She read it. She was horrified. I've found poetry, especially my verse, to have had that effect on many people, especially women, especially younger women. What were you thinking? She said. Where'd those words come from? She stared right through me. What if you'd put that up in my chip rather than my locker? It'd gotten up in the cloud. CIA, Virginia Intelligence Agency, or some other fools would have read it by now. My mother would have read it by now. It'd been podcast to the moon by now. Then what would you do? Nothing, I said. Nothing. Lays glared right through me some more. It's true, I said. Every word of it's true. True. Lays kept glaring, but her glare had softened. I almost saw a smile. What's the truth have to do with anything, Turner? What?
I really don't know. In retrospect, she wanted me to answer that or expected an answer.
I could not tell her one then. I could tell her one now that I'm over 80 years old. I could tell her that 13, 14-year-old boys are disastrously romantic. Either the boys get the girl, and if he doesn't, which is most likely the case, he, like a speeding Chevrolet on a NASCAR racing circuit, would go too high into the third turn in the oval, hit the wall, and twist and flip and over and into a spinning, exploding fireball. Doesn't seem to be anything in between for most adolescents, most men in general.
You didn't show this to anybody, did you?
Now here Lays sounded like my first editor, after I showed him an early draft of one of my first books. A necessary book, in my opinion, but perhaps not a heart-stopping thriller. It was entitled Louisiana-East Texas Wars, 2034 through 2040, an economic and military history. Why don't you just put that manuscript in your drawer for a while, he advised. I turned around and won a Pulitzer Prize. With that damn thing, I fired that man.
And what am I supposed to do with this, Lays said.
Lays held up the ring I'd given her along with the poem. I'd called that little brass thing a token. In the poem, I'd called it a token of my esteem, a keepsake, which is a remarkable word. Keepsake, very nice word, a word that unfortunately has been beaten down by the greeting card companies. But as I said, I was a horribly romantic boy. I do not care what you do with it, I pouted, I shrugged. But at the same time, I remember I could not help but proudly show Lays the secret compartment in the ring once you twisted the imitation pearl to the side. Lays thought for a moment. She said, I will keep it. And I will keep it and I'll put it somewhere appropriate. Lays actually talked like that. She talked like a princess or an elf queen or something out of a book. She had read far, far too many fantasies for anybody's good, including mine. She had posters of dragons on her walls. I secretly liked them. She took off her necklace, most likely given to her by an aunt. She had a number of aunts, way too many, a passel of them. And she slipped the ring on to the necklace. She began to hang the necklace back around her neck. She said, Turner, please help me get this back on. I stood behind her, the two ends of the clasp shaking in my hands. That was the moment when I was introduced to the nape of Lays' neck. There's another wonderful word for you, nape, nape of the neck.
What the hell are you doing back there?
Lays pulled the necklace away from me and clasped it herself.
Will you be going to the property?
Lays had changed the subject, but it was the same subject. What to do with me?
Depends, I said. Depends on what?
depends if there's anything up there to do. I can't imagine, Lays said. The property, that's with a capital P, was up on the east slope of the Appalachian Mountains north of the small town of Iberia. A little portion of that land bent over Alice Gap, looked west over the Shenandoah Valley. It was the prettiest piece of land in the world, bar none. It was property my father had acquired out of the old Shenandoah National Park privatization sale. The park, all national parks, had been privatized and sold off back in the teens. It was one of the worst and stupidest things the erstwhile U.S. federal government had ever done or could have thought about doing, getting rid of the park system. It weakened the government's stance further. It further eroded anyone's faith in them and put the Grand Canyon in the possession of a Japanese pet food manufacturer. Now, my father had bought 10,000 acres of Shenandoah National Park up on the east slope of the northern section. He did it quickly and quietly, no questions asked, with a questionable survey and cash on the barrelhead. Lays's father had purchased an additional parcel, 1,000 acres, right next door. Our families were neighbors, as always. So there was many, many a summer, many a weekend, when the property was Lays's in my backyard. There was no end to all that land. And at the time, I did believe that Lays and I would live forever together in the dark woods along Colvin Creek, amongst the ancient apple orchards and the mountain laurel, amongst the sweet hum of the bees and Queen Anne's lace and the red-tailed hawks floating overhead. I wanted nothing more. Like many lawyers, my father was something of an Anglophile. He had read and was fascinated by the English forest laws of the 11th and 12th centuries. My father had envisioned a grand scheme for the property. He saw this land his land, in almost feudal terms, to be protected, to be set aside, to be nurtured, and to be employed at his discretion. Of course, with the collapse of the several United States, not so many years later, none of my father's grand ideals for his property ever amounted to much. But he did hire Sam Bellows and called him his gamekeeper. It was a title Sam took seriously. His kin were from around those parts and had been for many, many generations. Back to the first English boats, back to the first flintlocks, back to Governor Dinwiddie. Yes, he took the land seriously. Sam Bellows was a man of many and distinct talents. He could shoe a horse, fix a carburetor, prescribe folk remedies. He could hunt a deer with a rifle or a bow or a slingshot. Didn't matter to him. He was perfectly capable of living off the land. He was a man of and for a different century. He'd been happier in the 15th and 19th centuries than in the 21st. I have no doubt about that. Now, this is a Sam Bellows that Lays mentioned in her final message to me in my chip, the chip inside my head behind my left eye. I believed the message to be true. I didn't believe the cloudburst data virus, in all its many incarnations, had gotten to Lays's message. It was a simple one. Wasn't altered or twisted. It said, thought of Sam Bellows, thought of the trail, thought of walking. Love, Lays. Then the communication went dead, of course. But I did believe that Lays was somehow going to try to head to the place in the world she knew and loved best. Property. So had she somehow contacted Sam Bellows? That was the question. She knew him well. She sat on his knees, a baby girl. But how could she have gotten hold of the man? He had no chip in his head, would not allow it. Sam lived off the grid, most every kind of grid you could imagine. Federal, digital, electrical, chemical, whatnot. He did not live on it. He lived off it. He would have none of the bio-digitized nonsense, as he called it. No chip in his head. Finally, came down to how could I contact Sam? How could I tell him that Lays, our darling Lays, was coming his way? And that's, of course, when my mother rushed in and said the Fitzgerald family had just received a damaged package from the regional authorities in Ohio. Everybody was an authority of some sort back then, especially in Ohio. package had been torn open and resealed a number of times before it had arrived at its final destination in Richmond. It contained a wallet, a credit card, an old family photograph, a ring of little or no value, and a 346TS Digitex optical bioimplant registered to an Eliza S. Fitzgerald, Richmond, Virginia. Short form letter accompanied these items, stating that the country of Ohio did not indemnify these items, nor could the country of Ohio be held in any way, shape, or form responsible for the said items. Now, several states may have found the freedom from each other, but they had not found any freedom at all from the fear of the law's many, many retributions. The form concluded by saying that, quote, personal items were found in the possession of two other citizens of Virginia, Edward and Duane Covington, minors. These minors had been and would continue to be detained in Ohio. They had been arrested for having no papers and impersonating Ohioans. Now, as I remember, Eddie and Duane Covington would have had a hard time impersonating human beings, much less Ohioans, but that's what they are picked up for. They then later were accused and detained for indenture trafficking. Now, you might remember from the last chapter of these remembrances that 15 of the 33 children on board of Lays' Christian Mission bus headed for Chicago had been impressed in Ohio and sent to Texas for tax indentures. Apparently, the Covington family had a small business venture going in the buying and selling of human indentured souls. And that was frowned upon by states such as Ohio, who claimed rights to the same foul business. The person not named in all this blather was Rayford Covington, Eddie and Duane's elder brother, who had been hired to provide security for the Christian Mission Transit Company. Eddie and Duane, they were stupid. Rayford, he was dangerous. He'd had a number of run-ins with Sam Bellows for poaching and vandalism and whatnot. Ray's a ghost, a ghoul, Sam once said. Just like his father, he'd break something just to see it wobble and hurt. Rayford was missing. Lays was missing. I ran over to the Fitzgerald's house and I barged in and I demanded to see the ring. Your manners are worse than ever, Turner, Lays's mother said, but she handed over the ring. I twisted the imitation pearl to the side. I said I found nothing, but I pocketed the little itty-bitty digit chip that was in there. I said I was sorry about Lays. I was so sorry. And I ran back home, opened the chip, read it, and I did the only thing I could think of doing. Took my father's truck and drove off into the night. More recollections to come. Turner Ashby.